Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Bill Stork. He is the owner of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Been with us a number of times. He's also author of three books. He writes a blog and contributes articles to local newspapers as well. And we're zeroing in a bit today on pet microchips and also how to shop for flea and tick products. I'd love to have you part of the conversation. What questions do you have about flea and tick prevention in pets? Have you ever reported a lost pet? Is your pet microchip? Join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about microchips to begin with. Describe what a microchip looks like.
Well, it looks like a grain of rice, to be honest with you. And they've been around since way back when I was in school, which is in the 80s. And we used to put them in production animals to be able to trace them very easily. But they're tiny little, about the size of a grain of rice that we inject under the skin over their shoulder blades. And from that moment forward, that animal is permanently identified because that microchip has a unique number that can be tied to a database, and that animal can be scanned and identified and looked up.
How do they work? Somebody asked me, how do they work?
Man, you're going to have an engineer on the program to answer that question. I can tell you that they work, and I can tell you that from our end, once we inject that microchip into the animal, then many of us, veterinary clinics, humane societies, police departments have scanners, and we scan over the dog in the general direction of the chip, and a number will pop up that correlates to that microchip. That number is in a database, a grand database. The chips that we use are home again, and you can look them up on the internet under the Home Again website and connect the owner to that animal. And that's actually a really good point as well. Animals are frequently microchipped by way of the Humane Societies, microchipped by way of rescues, microchipped by way of the breeders. And it's really important when you adopt that pet, when you purchase that pet, to take that step and make sure you transfer the ownership information to you, the new owner, and the pet with your particular information. Also, when people change addresses, telephone numbers, and email, when they change contact information, also very important to change that information so that it is all relevant. So God forbid if you should lose track of your pet, you can reconnect the dots.
Yeah, boy. So there's some things to remember after it's done. You just can't forget about it.
Yeah, you can't just plug and play.
Yeah, it's. Somebody wondered if it was painful to insert the, for you to do that.
You know, it's pretty incredible because it's a large needle that we insert the microchip. I wouldn't want it under my skin, but we do a couple of things. A lot of times we'll use local anesthesia, we'll use topical lidocaine, and it's a really good quality needle, frankly, mechanically, that amazingly most animals react very little. And if the timing of it all works out well, for example, if we're spaying or neutering them, oftentimes we'll insert the microchip when they're spayed and neutered. So then they don't feel anything.
They don't feel it at all. No, don't feel it at all. So let's say a cat comes wandering or a dog comes wandering to my house. What and it's lost. Looks like it's lost. What do I do? What do you do if you find a lost pet?
Well, if it's a cat and it's my wife, then you invite it in and you feed it, and it becomes part of the herd. They're part of the flock. But then again, we live out in the country. So a perfect question. And the first answer in 2022, what a lot of people will do is they'll post it on social media. And especially because in social media, people in the same geographic proximity, whether it be a town or out in the country, have a tendency to be part of the same Facebook groups and stuff like that. It's amazing how frequently animals find their way back home by way of social media, Facebook in particular. But if that doesn't serve you well, then the next order of business, you can call. First of all, you look for physical identification on the animal. Frequently, cats are not famous for wearing collars and tags. Dogs oftentimes do. If it is safe to approach that animal and search for identifying tags or collars, which is also a really good point, to make sure your pets have an outward identification on them, because at times people will microchip them, which is great if you happen to have a microchip scanner at home. But if not, it's good to have a visible identification on your animals. If they do, then you can find their way back home that way. If not, if there's no outward visible identification, then the next step is to search for a microchip. And Humane Society's police departments and veterinary clinics are more than happy to scan them and look for those identifications. Then the next step, is to always call your Humane Society, because people have a tendency to think that if they call the Humane Society, then they have to take the animal to the Humane Society. That's not necessarily the case. The Humane Society is oftentimes the first telephone call for people who have lost their pets. So you can get back that way as well.
Makes good sense. Mary in Whitewater has something to add to this whole microchip business. Mary, thanks for calling.
Yes, I have a good news story to tell about microchipping. But first, I want to highly recommend that everybody microchip their cats, even though they're indoor cats, because you never know when they're going to get loose. But my good story is that I was rescuing a little female cat off the street, and I had her coming indoors, but she could not adjust to my other indoor cat, so I would let her out at during the day, and then she would come in at night to eat and sleep. And one day she didn't come back, and I couldn't find her, and I searched the neighborhood for her. Nobody could tell me about her. So I waited 3 months, and I went to my veterinarian, and I said, take her off your records. She's gone. She's dead. 7 months later, exactly 7 months later, I get a call from a Humane Society telling me that my little kitty named blah, blah, blah belonged to me, and she was turned into the Humane Society, and the microchip on her indicated that I was the owner. And I said, there's no way, she's dead. And they said, well, the microchip doesn't lie.
Well, that's a good story, Bill.
Oh, you bet. And cats do some strange things. Cats will hitch rides on vehicles, and we have heard some crazy stories about cats ending up far away from home, which makes the microchip even more valuable.
Yeah, great story, Mary. Thank you so much.
And also to echo Mary's sentiment, cats can sneak out through doors and windows, and even though we like to think they're going to be inside all the time, they have their way of making their way outside.
You know, one of my cats, Tiger, leaned up against the screen window in the summer on the first floor and must have leaned, you know, just sleeping, I'm sure, because he doesn't like to get out. But he fell through, and I wasn't aware of it till much later. And it was about 3 days before I got him back. So, and Tiger is both cats are indoor cats. So it's kind of scary when you have an indoor cat only and it gets out. It's very scary. Tom and Madison, will give you a chance.
Good morning, Larry. I am enjoying the show as much as I enjoy it on every other day that I listen.
Thank you.
My puppy was microchipped by his veterinarian, and the service is called SaveThisLife.com. And what I'm wondering about is the permanency of the data. It says once it's chipped, you know, anybody can retrieve this data. But I believe that one of the pieces of literature I received with this stated that, you know, after 3 years or 5 years, there was some kind of fee for the owner, presumably to maintain the data in their database. I'm not looking at it right now, but I'm pretty sure there was something that implied, you know, you would have to pay a fee later. And if so, I think a practice like that really is, you know, below the belt and should be outlawed. Once your pet has its chip, I don't see where it should cost you additional money down the line to maintain the data in their database.
Well, and a fabulous point, and I'm very glad that you called. And you said it seemed as if, and that would be the fine print, business is business, and it's not unusual for these companies to attempt to upsell you additional products. And I can speak to the Home Again chips that when you buy that chip for $50 and we insert that chip, it is for life. And that $50 gets you that information and that database for life. But they will also attempt to upsell you additional services beyond that.
Mm. Okay, so you don't have to, once you pay your $50 or whatever it might amount to, that should be it. And unless you are intrigued by upsell that the company had, you don't need it.
Correct.
Okay. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Well, let's open it up a little more and talk about flea and tick prevention. You know, we're a Lyme disease state. Maybe you can explain how ticks spread Lyme disease to pets.
Man, it's pretty impressive what they do, and I'll back up just a little bit and share some statistics. And those statistics are that pretty much from shore to shore in the state of Wisconsin, we're approaching a point where 50% of the ticks in our area are deer ticks. And of those deer ticks, we're approaching the point where 50% of them are Lyme positive. And man, if you want to talk about an adapted little organism, that would be the tick, because they overwinter exceptionally well. Oftentimes people have a tendency to think that ticks don't come on until we're mowing grass and the leaves are on the trees. But in actuality, right now, or actually a couple of weeks ago, is one of the highest times of the year for ticks being active and Lyme transmission. Anytime the temperatures are above 35 degrees, ticks get active and ticks are seeking blood meals. They're extremely active in the early spring. They're extremely active later on in the fall as well. And there are some intricacies in here, but the ticks that transmit Lyme disease to our pets, especially during those times of the years. And sparing you the details of it all, when they land on a pet, there's a procedure by which they anchor themselves in. and they have mouth parts that look like a directional boring machine that inject themselves into the skin of the tick. So simply put, it takes them a while to set up shop on our pets. So there's at least 24 hours from the time they land on the tick and start to initiate a land on the pet and start to initiate a blood meal before they can actually transmit Lyme disease. And many of the products, the reliable products that we use to kill ticks on our pets will kill ticks within 24 hours. And if we can paint with a broad brush, most of these products are essentially neurotoxins for the ticks. And ticks have a very unique central nervous system, and most of the products interrupt the central nervous system of the tick and kill them within 24 hours of them landing on the pet and initiating a blood meal.
Our guest today, Dr. Bill Stork, he owns and operates Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Courtney Everett, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him with us. Questions for him. We've zeroed in a bit on microchipping and tick and flea prevention, but we'll take other questions too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org. So, what are the symptoms of Lyme disease in our pet? You know, what shows up in the pet?
Well, we have a bit of a luxury in our pets compared to people, in the sense that from the time one of our pets, dogs in particular, are infected with Lyme disease, there is usually a longer latent period. But what we'll notice first is either just a generalized lethargy, low-grade undulating fever. The classic presentation for Lyme disease in dogs is a subtle and variable lameness. And there's a bit of a historical perspective here because I'm as old as I look on the radio, and Lyme disease is one that I've essentially come up with. One of my classmates in veterinary school literally worked in the lab where they first identified Lyme disease. So way back in the beginning, in the early 90s, the classic history that we would see is, man, on Wednesday, he seemed like he was a little hurting on his right front. And then next Tuesday, it seems as if he was picking up his left rear and he was eating less and he's just been generally less active. So those are among the early signs of Lyme disease in dogs. One of the more catastrophic effects of Lyme disease, about 10% of dogs that become clinical with Lyme disease will develop kidney failure, Lyme nephritis. And that is particularly devastating. Those dogs will go off food. They will be really lethargic. They're likely to vomit. And those dogs will have elevated renal values, elevated kidney enzymes as well. And those dogs are really difficult to save.
I guess like everything else, the earlier you catch it, the better your chances. And I'm wondering, you know, owners should be checking their pets, and what are the best ways to kind of check your cat or your dog for fleas?
Well, of course,
I'm sorry, for the
for the tick?
Yeah, for ticks. The best way is physical inspection, and thankfully, most of us spend a great deal of time with our pets, and we groom them, and we brush them, and we physically look for them. But of course, you know, if you've got yourself a Newfoundland or a Golden Retriever that weighs 85 pounds with a big, luxurious coat of hair, those ticks can be pretty elusive until they're engorged. And we'll frequently be asked in the exam room, people can understandably be hesitant to put products into or on their pets to prevent the transmission of Lyme disease and to kill ticks. And I understand that, but of course, we're always weighing risks versus benefits. And in my mind, the best way to prevent Lyme disease is one, safe, appropriate products for your breed and your dog's lifestyle that kill and prevent the transmission of ticks. And for dogs who live the Lyme life, dogs that go up north, once you get north of Wausau, or especially the Baraboo Dells area, for example, are virtual Lyme hotspots, and it is really endemic in those areas throughout the entire state, but especially in those areas. We recommend the Lyme vaccine, which is a pretty darn effective and pretty darn safe vaccine.
We have Tom from Onalaska, who called and says he worked in a factory that made microchips. He says there are two types of chips, one that is active, which has a battery, and one that is passive, which means it doesn't have a battery. And he said all those on pets are passive. Since the microchips are so small, they would scan those chips as they moved around the factory. A wand indicates the chip and sends a signal. So they're passive, not active. You don't need a battery, which is a good thing.
No, but actually that's a really good point. We haven't figured out a way to make a microchip active within the pet yet. But we're talking about dogs and cats that have a tendency to wander. There are a number of products out there. There's some sort of an Apple chip that you can put on your dog's collar. And there are also GPS collars that are really sensitive and really accurate. I have a number of my clients who have GPS collars on their dogs, so they can trace them like Billy from Family Circus around the neighborhood. You know exactly where they are.
How much are they? Roughly, I'm sure it varies.
They're actually like a lot of things in technology. The prices are really reasonable.
All right. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Someone was wondering, how do you remove it? What's the best way to get a tick out of your pet?
Well, the best way to get a tick out of your pet is they make these crazy little microscopic fork deals called a tick twister that will wedge themselves between the mouth parts of the ticks that have burrowed into the skin and the skin. If you don't by chance have a tick twister on you, the smallest needle that you have, you can tease the skin from around the tick off of them. If you have a pair of hemostats or tweezers or anything like that. And you don't always get all of the parts. And if you don't always get all of the mouth parts, it's not fatal or life-threatening. It very well may cause an abscess in that area, but at least it will not be transmitting Lyme disease anymore or the other tick-borne diseases that we see.
Yeah, for sure. And the treatment, if you find a pet, your pet with an engorged tick, probably you should get to your vet.
You bet. And what we'll oftentimes recommend is if you find an engorged tick on your pet today, then one of a couple of different approaches can work. We'll usually recommend testing for Lyme disease in about 3 weeks, because from the time when that animal is exposed to the time that they will become Lyme positive is about 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks. So we won't necessarily recommend testing them right away.
And if they come back in 3 weeks and they are positive, then...
Then opinions may vary amongst my colleagues out there, and these decisions have a tendency to be predicated on the pet, the lifestyle, owner preference. There is a test, because the test that we use in the clinic is a test that looks for exposure to the ticks. It does not necessarily mean that your dog has Lyme disease. Many pet owners will recommend, if that thing shows up positive, I'm treating that dog with doxycycline for 28 days. It's a pretty well-tolerated, fairly benign antibiotic. And if in doubt, treat it, which is the approach that many prefer. There is a test called the C6 test that is a quantitative titer that helps distinguish between exposure and active disease. Some may choose to decide whether to treat based on the results of that titer. In my mind, if there's any doubt whatsoever, I choose to treat them. The C6, the titer, is very good medicine because it allows us to compare numbers later on if symptoms should persist. Hmm. Or to see if treatment has been successful.
And I'm wondering about the, you know, you see tick and flea preventives, you know, that you can apply to your animal in one way or another. Are there a couple of different chemicals, one that treats the fleas and one that treats the ticks, or in those products?
Well, most of them, and as we alluded to earlier, most of them, and oh boy, it's beyond the scope of this discussion and maybe even beyond the scope of me, because there's so many products to attempt to keep track of out there. And back in the day, essentially, we used insecticides that were rather broad spectrum insecticides. What those products have become now is, as I alluded to, they attack or disable or uncouple the central nervous system of either ticks or fleas, and either paralyze them or kill them by disrupting their central nervous system. And in doing so, they're much more specific to the ticks and to the fleas, and much safer to the pets.
Mm-hmm. And can most flea and tick products be taken or used for puppies?
They're going to be specific. There's a few that are specific that we are more likely to use on puppies. One of the products that we use fairly commonly is labeled for dogs past 6 months of age. So your veterinarian is going to make a recommendation based on breed, size, mm-hmm. age, lifestyle.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. And are there times when it doesn't work? Or what would cause a topical flea and tick prevention product to be not effective?
Well, we will see on occasion some of the products that we've had out there for a very long time, like Frontline, for example, has been around for a very long time. We think that there's a possibility that some populations of ticks can develop resistance to it. We think that there are times when it doesn't distribute over the animal the way that we expect it to do. And they're labeled to be pretty effective, even if they get wet. But if they get wet before it has an opportunity to be absorbed and distributed, that's another way they can not be effective.
Mm. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, we're taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Bill, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. We've talked flea and ticks. We've talked about microchipping, but we'll take other questions as well about your pet's health, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. So, Dr. Bill, what are some typical things that you see as a veterinarian this time of year in the pets that come into your shop?
Well, we just came out of a period when we saw a pretty good parade of animals with paw and nail lesions because we're just coming out of a period of the time when the ground was frozen and the snow was in retreat, but then it got cold again. So it was tough going out there between the ice and snow that had retreated and then frozen back down again. And then dogs were getting out and having some cabin fever and wanting to rip and tear, and they tore up their feet that way. You know, this morning we saw dogs that were out enjoying 75 degrees and sunshine yesterday and pulled up lame on a right front leg and a right rear leg. And so athletic injuries are not unusual this time of year as well.
Oh, man, you could join in. Some people joining in right now, but there's still, I think, a line open for you. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@WPR.org. Becca emailed, by the way. She's a Wisconsin Humane Officer, and she says, it's important to note that it's required by law in the state that when a person not a humane officer or animal control officer or similar takes a stray animal into custody, they must deliver it to a shelter or animal control. And so, and that's a good point to remember. Cindy in Menominee Falls will give you a chance. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I'm just calling with a little bit of a cautionary tale. My dog, Jem, got very sick with anaplasmosis a year ago. I had had him vaccinated against Lyme disease, and I wasn't treating for ticks year-round, thinking it was okay during the winter, which was obviously very wrong. He had gotten apparently infected from a tick last March and became very sick. So I guess my point is that it's not just Lyme disease that we need to be aware of.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah,
no, that's absolutely the case. And in 2021, there were 42 days when it was too cold for ticks to be active in 2021.
Wow, only 42 days.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And that is a most excellent point because we speak in broad terms about Lyme disease, but anaplasmosis, which is usually more benign than Lyme disease, but clearly it can be devastating as well. There's Ehrlichiosis, and I contend there's osises out there that we don't know the name of yet because, you know, 30 years seems fairly recent for us to only have learned about Lyme disease. So we know there's others out there. So
yeah. Yeah.
All the more important to prevent ticks anytime we can.
Cindy, thanks again. Appreciate it. Mary in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Love your show. I love listening to your show. Thank you so much. I have a question about, you were talking about the flea and tick medicines, and I'm just wondering if that's carcinogenic, if that's toxic in an accumulative way to my dog. I have a golden retriever, and we administer that, I think, like every 3 to 4 months as directed, and the topical medicine. And is there any, I mean, I've heard that, you know, it can kind of go either way. Certainly we don't want our dog to get Lyme's disease, but is there a toxic effect from these administering these medicines?
Well, Mary, you bring up a very common and valuable concern. And as I threw in earlier, we're always weighing the risks versus the benefits in any given situation. And what we rest assured of is before these products get approved by the FDA in the United States, they have to subject to massive research studies. And there is some degree of truth that oftentimes the products that we're using here in the United States have been available in Europe for considerably longer than they ever make it to us. And they're, and because we keep getting more and more specific about their mechanisms, we're pretty confident, especially with regard to being carcinogenic, that risk, in my mind, others may have other opinions, but in my mind is very low. And once again, by my way of thinking, you know, 50% of the ticks out there are deer ticks, and 50% of them are Lyme positive, and that risk is much greater than the possibility of downstream risks. One of the risks that was in the popular press and on social media for a very long time was the potential association with seizures. And one of the products, some of the products, because we can speak in generalities because they use the same active ingredient, were associated with seizures in dogs. And people would come to us saying, well, I heard that this product causes my dog to have seizures. Well, no, that's not the case. When they do the research and a dog that is on a treatment has a seizure, they have to report that dogs given this treatment had seizures. There were also dogs in the control group that did not get any treatment at all who had seizures as well. So we don't feel as if these products cause seizures, but we're very cautious in dogs with seizures as to how we treat them and what we use for flea and tick prevention.
Yeah. Kind of to go along with that, there was an email from Marilyn. Her dogs, they kind of had a negative reaction to applied tick treatments, especially the oral ones. And wonders about the collars or other methods that do the job without adverse effects. And it sounds like, well, I'm wondering, are the collars as good as the oral?
Yeah, not in my mind, but indeed. If you read the list of potential side effects and you practice long enough, you will find a few dogs who get gastrointestinal upset as a result of the products. Thankfully, it's transient, it's non-life-threatening, but not something that we would seek. And for those dogs, then there's a collar called a Seresto collar that has a tendency to be much more effective than some of the old white permethrin and organophosphate collars that we used to use. They distribute better. They're much safer than those old collars and much more effective. And one of the things that people like about the collars are that they can put them on and take them off. So if they're going to be in town inside the enormous majority of the time, but there's a period when they're going to go up north out to the lake, to the bike trail, wherever ticks have a tendency to congregate, then they can put the collars on and be protected. And that's certainly an appeal.
Absolutely. Dr. Bill Stork, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, our guest today. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Bill Storick, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Great to have him with us. And certainly, if you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Helen in Middleton. Hi, Helen. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have an 11-year-old short-haired cat, and this year particularly, she has been having hairballs almost every other day or every third day. I've tried some stuff that comes in a tube from the grocery store, and it hasn't helped. She seems real healthy otherwise. And she always leaves these little piles of throw up on the carpet, never in the kitchen or the bathroom.
Of course. It would have to be the carpet. It's not a hardwood floor. Dr. Bell?
Well, the products that you described, the paste that are essentially lubricants and laxatives, are a great place to start with a cat that is vomiting hairballs. If we're speaking strictly to hairballs and mitigating those effects, then some people will groom them so that the cat has less fur to consume in the first place, and therefore less hair to deposit on your valuable area rug and on your carpet. But if I have a cat that is 11 years old, that is vomiting and regurgitating frequently, and I'm using those products like the paste and things like that, and the problem persists, I may take a couple steps backwards and have your veterinarian check the cat out, make sure that his or her weight is stable, and quite possibly do some diagnostics, do some blood work to ensure that it is actually the hairballs that are causing the vomiting and not possibly some sort of kidney disease, thyroid disease, and other cause that is resulting in the vomiting of the hairballs.
Yeah. So maybe get the kitty to the vet and see what the vet has to say about it, Helen. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Abby in River Falls, on to you now. Hi, Abby.
Hey, I have a question. I have two small children in my house, and I was wondering what the best flea and tick medication is to use on my dog that won't affect my children and rub off on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, perfect and most relevant question. We, over the years, have become fans of the oral flea and tick protections. And I so far have worked hard not to use brand names so as not to come across as endorsing anything in particular, but Brevecto is one that has proven to be very effective, very safe, and infrequently, not often, do we see dogs have side effects as a result of it, and it kills fleas and ticks effectively and quickly.
And what was it again? Give that name once more.
Well, the brand name is Brevecto, which it took me a really long time to get used to, because when that product first became available to us, I didn't want to prescribe it because I couldn't stand the name of it. And because here we are programmed over all these years to use products once a month, and it is a product that we use every 3 months. In the years that we've had it, it's proven to be most excellent protection, and we always qualify these things, but almost always well tolerated in the pets that we use it, as in it's not prone to create vomiting, diarrhea, things like that.
And it appears to be safe for children.
Well, not if they take it.
But if they pet the dogs.
Of course. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. There you go, Abby. Thank you very much for calling. Diana from Lincoln County sent us an email about a story. It's a cool story. The Lincoln County Humane Society posted on its Facebook page. At the end of February, the organization found a cat who seemed to be unable to use her back legs, but otherwise appeared healthy. The Humane Society transported her to an area vet who made a determination that her injuries were treatable. And fortunately, the cat was microchipped, and they were able to get in touch with the owner and found out, surely, the cat had been missing for nearly 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man. What a story. So 2 years later, Shirley gets treated and good shape and back to her owner.
And that's awesome.
Yeah, that's an awesome story. Thanks for sending that in. Kathy from Franklin called with a question, wondering about Lyme disease immunizations for cats and dogs. Is it the same that they use for people, and she wonders, where is the medical research on Lyme disease?
Well, the answer is we don't have a Lyme vaccine for cats, to the extent that we're not even sure how Lyme disease affects cats, to be honest with you. And with regard to people, we don't yet have a vaccine for Lyme disease in people. And not a physician, do not pretend to be a physician. I'm not a physician on television, but what we're working towards with regard to a vaccine for Lyme disease in people, we're trying to figure out a way that we can vaccinate against the saliva of the tick. So that we can not only prevent Lyme disease, but we can prevent the other tick-borne diseases. As a previous caller had talked about anaplasmosis, you don't have to ask very many people to find someone who's been affected by anaplasmosis. It's wicked, mean, and nasty in people. Larry's raising his hand. Ehrlichiosis, and once again, the others that we don't yet know about.
And in terms of research or publications on ticks and fleas?
Man, where I find all the research is in the journals above my head, because one of the most active areas of research in tick biology, there's a couple of them, one of which is the University of Kansas. I listened to a lecture by a PhD DVM from the University of Kansas, who researches life cycles, prevalence, transmission of ticks. And then I don't know if you've ever been to the CDC website. They're kind of a hot topic as of late, but the CDC website is one of the most complete and intuitive sites that I've ever found. And you can look up diseases that you've heard of and diseases that you never have and find out anything and everything you ever wanted to know there.
Yeah, that's a very, very good place to go. Appreciate that question for sure. Well, we had Diane from Madison sent us an email. She has a friend whose cat got very sick after she treated her dogs with a topical flea tick product, but apparently dog products can be toxic to cats. In this case, the friend pet her dog, then pet the cat and transferred the oil. Mm-hmm. And
yep, there's a few that we use that are specific to dogs. And there's another reason. A previous caller, we're concerned about her kids coming in contact with it, and cats as well. another argument, when appropriate, to use the orals as well.
Yeah, it makes good sense. And the difference between a product that's once a month versus 3 months, is it?
To my knowledge, there's only one product that's effective for 3 months, and that's an oral product. And there again, to my knowledge, I feel as if the topical products are once a month.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today on the show. He's the owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. You can join in right now. There's a couple of people joining in as I speak, as a matter of fact. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Dr. Bill Stork. I'm Larry Mehler. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your pet's health on the program today. Larry Mehler here with my guest, Dr. Bill Stork. He's been with the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic over 25 years, works with both small and large animals. He's also an author of 3 books, writes a blog, and contributes articles to local newspapers. I hope you'll join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Ruth in Gordon, Wisconsin. It's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I called in to see if he knew information about the source, the real source of blastomycosis. Because I got blastomycosis. I don't know how I got it. And I'm still recovering. It's been almost 2 years. And then my dog has blastomycosis, and he's about 6 months into treatment.
And you have, if I'm reading this right, you have a little river creek that runs through your property, and your dog loves to play in the water, in the river.
We both. Yeah, it's a great kayaking, you know, I got a trail and it goes back and we get in and we kayak and he loves, you know, he's part golden retriever and lab.
Yep, and he loves that water. Well, I'm thinking it's that little creek or river, Dr. Bill. I can't be sure, I suppose, but it could be, couldn't it?
Boy, Larry, all these years on the radio, I don't think you need me anymore. you're spot on with regard to blastomycosis, and it is a wicked, mean, and nasty, sneaky little disease, and blasto exists in low-lying, wet, marshy areas, rotting soil, wood, things like that. It's a spore born organism that enters our body by way of aerosol. We inhale it, and then those spores will sit dormant for any period of time in our lungs, and eventually they will disseminate. And when they disseminate, the blastomycosis organisms, they can find their way to the skin, the paws, the eye. We have suspected we found blastomycosis in the prostate of a male dog. It's far less common in the state of Wisconsin, far less common at large for people to become affected by blastomycosis, because most people don't get that close and don't dig in the dirt. But certainly, I mean, if you're gardening, if you're spending a lot of time by lakes and rivers and stuff like that, clearly it's extremely possible. And blasto is one of those diseases where early detection, early treatment is absolutely positively crucial to how successful we can be in treating these guys. So we don't test every dog that coughs, because that's one of the first signs of blastomycosis in dogs. We don't test for blasto in every dog that coughs, but if they live the lifestyle, then the threshold is pretty low before we go looking for it.
Yeah. So, and there's not a preventive short of avoiding water, I guess.
Yeah, no, there's no sort of vaccine. And of course, there's no products that we can use to prevent being exposed to blasto. And I don't have the heart to tell a golden retriever that they need to not play down by the river and by the lake, but we live in awareness. And if suspicious, we go looking for it.
Yeah. There you go, Ruth. Appreciate your call very much. Thank you for calling. Kathy in Sturgeon Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks. I have an 11-and-a-half-year-old greyhound who has he has a disease called FLO, F-L-O, symmetrical leukoid, and O. I don't know what the O stands for, but he used to be, I used to have him take the Lyme vaccine, and one of the vets that was working with him felt that there was a possibility that that vaccine might be making the slow disease a little bit worse, and so had recommended we not do that vaccine anymore. Have you ever heard anything about that?
Well, and it certainly makes sense, and I'm never going to fly in the face of another veterinarian's judgment, especially because they have your pet in front of them. And certainly what you're describing is an immune mediated disease. And then when we vaccinate them, then we're also recruiting the immune system as well. And also, I would be willing to bet that 11-and-a-half-year-old greyhound doesn't quite live the Lyme life that it once did as well. So it sounds as if you were getting some most excellent care up there in Sturgeon Bay. I would agree.
Yeah, there you go, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Philip in Bayfield County, we're on to you now. Hi, Philip.
Hi, thanks. I have an 11-year-old Alaskan Husky. She's a retired sled dog, so she lived a very active lifestyle her whole life. And in her old age, she's developed arthritis. She's also been treated for Lyme's twice. So my question for you is whether you recommend glucosamine or collagen for her joint health.
Yeah, you know, glucosamine, there's kind of a suite of a package of supplements that can be effective in supporting joint health. Glucosamine is one of them. Many people feel very strongly about the value of an herb that I will fail to pronounce correctly, and that's turmeric, but has proven to be effective as well. And I always am a little bit awkward when recommending glucosamine, because we can't specifically speak to the effectiveness, the mechanism of how it works. And it's not always supported by objective research. But then again, the effectiveness of joint supplements are really difficult to effectively and quantitatively research. But what I can tell you is that anecdotally, glucosamine seems to be beneficial to a number of pets. And also, it seems to be effective for a number of old veterinarians with bad knees, because I started taking glucosamine some number of years ago. And, you know, when I spend the day on the end of a chainsaw, it seems like I'm hobbling just a little bit less on my way back to the house.
Yeah, I take it too, as a matter of fact. It seems to help me too. So there you go. But turmeric, I guess, is I'm not sure how it's pronounced either exactly. But some of that in with the dog's chow or whatever is helpful.
Well, you bet. And other things that matter with regard to those supplements are quality, consistency.
Yeah.
And one thing that we do know for sure is glucosamine is of no value unless taken absolutely consistently. It's not going to be beneficial if taken periodically or as needed.
Yep. Yep. There you go, Philip. Thank you. Scott in Whitewater, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, I've got another question about arthritis. I have a Labrador Retriever who's 12 years old, and she has, through x-rays, shown to have arthritis through her back and in her right knee. And she's very good shape other than that, 45 pounds, and I hunt her year-round, and she loves, obviously, to be out there. But after a day of hunting, she will guard one over the other of her rear legs, putting no pressure on it. And I minimize the amount of jumping she does as far as in and out of the vehicle. I always lift her up. And she's on glucosamine and chondroitin supplements as well as meloxicam. And I'm just wondering, at her age, her mother lived to be 16. And I'm just wondering if there's anything else I can do to try to keep her more comfortable and get her out to hunt as she loves to do without her being in such, you know, rough shape for several days afterwards.
Okay.
Boy, you bet. It sounds like you guys have a great life there, Scott. And it also sounds as if you're doing all of the things that you can do with regard to the glucosamine, and meloxicam is a really nice non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug that makes these guys, oftentimes will help these guys be more comfortable. When you're talking about non-weight-bearing lame, I'm always curious. We always want to make sure that there's not a specific injury in there, like an anterior cruciate ligament is a really common injury. And one of my dogs, she was 12 years old when she tore her first anterior cruciate ligament. And, you know, if we know that this is just arthritis and she doesn't have any specific joint injuries in there and she's otherwise in excellent health, you know, motion is medicine. And we look to provide these guys the greatest quality of life we possibly can. You know, we may, as the years go marching on, tune down how long they hunt or how rough a ground that they hunt on. But you got to love a 12 and a half year old girl that's still out there hunting.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, thank you very much for calling. Let's see. We've got some emails. By the way, you could still join in, I believe, at 800-642-1234. But we have some emails to get to as well. Paul from West Bend wonders how ticks affect different animals in the wild, like rabbits or deer. Is it similar or different to how it affects pets?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm not exactly sure I know the answer to that question, to be honest with you. I'm not a wildlife veterinarian. And one of the things that we do know is from people who, for example, rabbit hunt, rabbits in the wild are absolutely famous for being covered with fleas. I'm going to have to claim ignorance on that for fear that I might say something that's absolutely incorrect.
Okay.
I don't know how Lyme disease affects deer and rabbits.
Beth from Eau Claire wants to know, is there a Lyme vaccine for horses?
No, there is not. a line, well, we don't largely vaccinate horses for Lyme disease at this point. And the equine specific veterinarians may be able to answer this question more definitively. But for a while, we know that some of the other tick-borne diseases affect horses, like, for example, anaplasmosis. We had a horse that was affected by anaplasmosis, one of the other tick-borne diseases. We're not 100% sure how Lyme disease affects horses, but there again, the equine-specific veterinarians might be able to provide a more fleshed-out answer to this. But to my knowledge, we're not vaccinating horses against Lyme yet.
Helen emailed and wonders, any long-term studies made for long-term effects on ticks, tick meds or pets? So many dogs are getting cancer when they're 10 or 12 years old, and wondering if, you know, maybe that's a problem.
Well, as long-term as we possibly can. And, of course, those concerns are always going to come up. What gets to be really, really challenging with regard to long-term research on cancer, whether it be in people or golden retrievers or Labrador retrievers, are it's very difficult to isolate particular causes because there are so many different things that they're exposed to in the environment, not to mention genetic and breed predispositions. It's really difficult to make conclusions in that fashion.
Don in Adams County has a question, I believe. Don, hello. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for your time. The question I have is, I've always had dogs, so many over the years, mostly labs and goldens. And so I've known the breed, without any problems. This last one is a rescue dog we've gotten. The nearest our vet can come is that it looks like it would be a cross between a Rhodesian Ridgeback and a Kerr, which I've been told is actually breed. But what about DNA testing? How do you feel about that, or is it very accurate? I can't really find much information on it.
Well, you've got yourself a whole lot of dog there. Cross between a Rhodesian Ridgeback and a Kerr. Well, the answer to the question with regard to the DNA tests are that they keep getting better and more specific. In the early days, we back when we used to have to send blood samples in, I did two consecutive DNA tests. And here again, this was 20 years ago, and they came back that they were Great Dane Chihuahua crosses. And at that point in time, I rather lost faith in the process. But like so many things, the technology keeps getting better and more specific. And the more numbers, the more specific we can get.
I had my friend's dog DNA tested in the last year or so. And there's a variety of tests and a variety of costs, and the costs are usually associated with the amount of detail that you want, at least as far as I could see. And you can get a lot of detail, or you can get enough detail, you know, to say, okay, well, it's the breed is this and that breed and another breed, and mostly, you know, whatever it was. In this case, it was a Staffordshire.
You bet. And not just breeds, but also predisposition, genetic markers for diseases as well.
Yeah,
you can get information along those lines also.
Thanks, Don. Carol in Janesville, what's on your mind?
Thank you. I had knee replaced about 8 years ago, and I'm supposed to have the other one replaced. They said that about 6 years ago, and instead I opted to have an injection, which originally I was told it was from the gel from a rooster's comb. I don't know if I misunderstood that or not. And the last two treatments I've had through ultrasound, and I think it's a product like Monovisc, and I wonder if they have treatments like that for dogs where they can inject this gel into the knee. It's given me wonderful relief.
Yeah, I had it too about 10 years ago, and it was Synvisc is what I used, or what the doctor used on me. But is there something like that for dogs?
Boy, I don't think so. One of the closest that I might envision is that we're looking at using PRP and stem cell therapy for some joint injuries, which what we're hoping out of those that stem cell therapy and the PRP is to be able to regenerate articular cartilage and make those animals more comfortable. It sounds as if the product that you guys are talking about might be a lubricant of sorts. And the orthopods might know of something that I'm not specifically aware of, but yeah, not to my exact knowledge.
Jerry wondered from Linden Station what they can put on pet rabbits for ticks or flea repellent. And I know it's different. You don't want to put a tick and flea for a dog on your rabbit.
Well, actually, there's some of them that are
that
safe.
That work?
Yeah. You bet. Yeah, some of the topicals are safe on rabbits. And we've kind of got a variety of them. And every time before I put it on a rabbit, I always check and make sure the safety of them. But absolutely, there are topicals we can use on them.
Well, I tell you what, on that note, we are about out of time, Dr. Bill. I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for all your good information. I hope you'll come back and do this again.
Oh, sure. That seems to come up in the rotation every few months.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks very, very much. Dr. Bill Stork is the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Also an author. He's got some fun books to read as well. It was great to have him with us today. I wanted to remind you that our book club is meeting via radio on Thursday. I hope you've had a chance to read Send for Me by Lauren Fox. She's from Milwaukee. It's a novel set in Germany on the eve of World War II and present-day Wisconsin. It's a really good book. It explores themes of sacrifice, belonging, and family ties. I hope you've read it. If you haven't read it, you could probably still get a copy and read some of it at least before Thursday. But if not, you're going to enjoy hearing about the book anyway. So I hope you'll tune in on Thursday for the novel Send for Me on the Larry Mueller Show Book Club right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at spring migration and the birds that are back in the state. Bill Volker joins us for that. So that's going to be a lot of fun, too. And I hope you'll stay with us right through the afternoon. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.